Welcome to the Gottesdienst crowd, where we foster confessional integrity, liturgical preservation, and preaching that doesn't stink. We believe that the historic liturgy of the divine service is more than mere cobwebs of antiquity, but it is a true treasure of the church to be dusted off and brought down from her attic to be enjoyed. So let's get dusting.
Welcome back to the Gottesdienst crowd. This is Jason Broughton. Today we have back with us Dave Peterson. Welcome back, Dave.
Thank you.
We are looking at the gospel reading for the third Sunday of Easter. It comes from John chapter 10, verses 11 to 16. I'll read that in the English Standard Version. Jesus said, "I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd, who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees. And the wolf snatches them and scatters them. He flees because he is a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my own and my own know me, just as the Father knows me and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. And I have other sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. So there will be one flock and one shepherd." Okay, so context, if it's kind of right in the middle of, or the very beginning and leaves out a whole bunch of stuff, is this a time to expand? Do we read all of John chapter 10?
Well, it sure would be nice to read 17 and 18. Therefore, my Father loves me because I lay down my life that I may take it again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down. I have power to take it again. This command I received from my Father. Mm-hmm. But really, it does even, as you say, I think to start back at verse 7, just to get this whole speech, you know, would be nice, the whole door of the sheep thing. But it, man, I mean, 17 and 18 are really significant verses. And directly, I mean, that's the third. He says, I lay down my life for the sheep. He says it three times. And but the third time is in verse 17, and we stop at 16. Yeah.
So how does this portion of John's gospel fit in with the man who was born blind, whom Jesus heals? Because immediately after all this, this is when they start charging him again, that he's got a demon, he's insane, because who can open eyes of the blind except for a demon? And
right.
So how does the shepherd image, how does that relate to the healing of the blind, if at all?
Well, I think the shepherd's not quite as nice as he seems on the surface, right? So you have back in chapter 9, after the man born blind, Jesus says, "For judgment I have come into the world, and those who do not see may see, and that those who see may be made blind." The Pharisees say, we're not blind. He says, if you were blind, you'd be fine, because you'd be healed, but you're going to remain in your sins.
Yeah.
So I think the connection here is that there are hirelings. That's part one. But then there are also just simply those that aren't part of his flock.
Mm. Okay.
And that's the reality.
So is
the, so, and again, they just demonstrate it, because then they say in verse 21, as you said, they again accuse him of having a demon.
Mm-hmm. So in the Vulgate version of Psalm 23, it says, "Not that the Lord is my shepherd, but the Lord is my ruler,
I didn't know that.
My regiment.
Dominus? Oh.
Huh. I'm pretty sure I'd have to look that up now again to be positive, but I just read this. Maybe it's not regiment, but it's not king, but it's a ruler. And
it's not pastor.
No, it's not pastor. And so the interesting thing I wonder is, I've always taken this as the shepherd here is just protecting his sheep, right? He's bringing them into the fold, and it's very kind of comforting and protective. But then thinking about its context immediately before and after, and how the Jews, at least that are against, are adversaries of Jesus, take it. It almost seems like what Jesus is saying is, okay, I'm the good shepherd. I'm going to do battle I'm going to be the ruler and do battle against those who are coming after my sheep.
Yeah. Well, shepherd is a kind of normal title for kings in the ancient world.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of the way that we use the word minister.
Yeah.
You know, a minister is a servant, literally. And so we talk about, you know, the defense ministry or the, right, mm-hmm. whatever. I can't even think of it. The prime minister, of course. But
yeah.
Right, this idea, civil service, right? Mm-hmm. Those kinds, that kind of language that we're accustomed to with service and servant and minister. That is the way. So if I said the prime minister or a civil service, it doesn't actually connotate in your mind somebody who's humble and wants to wash feet, right?
No.
Those engaged in the civil, right. So the prime minister, right? He's actually the chief guy, the executive. And I think there is that we sometimes miss, that when he says shepherd, it is kingly language,
yeah.
or, you know, ruler. Though I think translating it as ruler, I mean, into Latin seems like a strange choice, but mm-hmm. but that would be the reason, because there's, yeah. In fact, I think it was Lindemann that said something about we ought to be careful we don't get caught up in sentimentality
right.
on this particular Sunday.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so I guess the question for me then is this image of shepherd as kingly, one who rules and reigns in such a way that not only is he protective, but also doing battle against the enemies in order to protect, right? He's not like David, who doesn't go out to war in the springtime and remains in Jerusalem and remains in the comfort, but he actually lays his life down. He's at the tip of the spear. How does this play with Easter and what's going on in the season of Easter?
Well, if we had verse 18, we'd have a resurrection passage that he takes it up again. There is also, before we go to Easter, just again, you know, verse 19, that the immediate response to this is division.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So he is the dividing. They do respond very negatively to these words. I think the Easter thing that in the shepherd imagery, particularly with Psalm 23 in the background, there is the whole idea of new life. Right.
Okay.
And that, you know, there is this. So even though this is divisive and not everybody's in this flock, those who are in the flock are being led to green pastures and still waters and being cared for. So I think that's the Easter thing,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah. So is this a time to kind of bring in that Chesterton quote about the soldier does not go to war and battle because he hates what's in front of him, but because he loves what's behind him?
Oh, nice. I didn't know that quote. There you go.
Okay.
good well, talk.
Thanks for coming on today, Dave. And
okay, so I think we can see three things here in 11 to 16. All right, so the good shepherd, he says he lays down his life for the sheep. And so in contrast to a hireling, also in contrast to the hireling, he knows the sheep and he is known. And then the third thing is he has other sheep. So we can, I think we can see this as really in a sense, three different works that are united, but he's the redeeming, knowing, and uniting. And all three of these things really are all in the cross, right? They're also all in his word, and they're also all in the Eucharist. So it is the cross that redeems us. It is the cross where he reveals the heart of the Father, right? Where the Father's name is glorified, and where the authority of Jesus is seen, really his divinity, both in his death and in his resurrection. And then also that is the doctrine of the atonement, or Christology, really kind of more precisely, that actually unites the church, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got in his word, of course, right? Faith cometh by hearing. And then, of course, it is, again, faith that is revealing, uncovering the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit to us. And it is, again, his word that actually changes us and therefore unites us. And then in the Eucharist, of course, it's for the forgiveness of sins. It is by his word. And it is a visible sign and confession of unity. Mm. So I think you can see all of that as a shepherd reality.
Okay. So
you responded to that just like I responded to your Chesterton quote. So
yeah, we're really on the button today.
really clicking with one another.
Okay. So do you expand here or do you just bring it in the sermon?
I can't remember. I think at least sometimes, maybe before Scammon got a hold of me, I think I did expand to 17 and 18.
Okay.
But I don't, you know, I just can't take being under Scammon's thumb. I did it for a year and I'm chafing.
Yeah.
Right.
So, I don't know. I think I would just bring it in the sermon itself.
How about do both? How about read it and bring it in?
Yeah, but I would want to go back, you know, to verse 7 or beginning of chapter 10, all about the strangers and the thieves and the robbers. And so,
right.
I mean, you could, obviously.
You could, yeah. But I mean, there is, right.
At some point, it's like when people want a portion of Romans 8 for their funeral, and you're like, where do you start? It's like you want to just put the whole thing in.
Well, we have this problem with hymns.
Yeah.
We can't cut stanzas of hymns.
Right. So.
And it can be kind of ridiculous.
So, I don't know. I think I would just bring it in. I would be more inclined to bring in the later verse, include or expand the later verses instead of the early ones. You can always bring the early context, but it's more difficult to bring the later context in the middle of a sermon, I think.
I think that's right.
So I'd be more inclined to add on.
Easier to set up stuff.
Yeah. So not that it couldn't be done, but okay. Yeah, so Translation, was there any issue or anything you wanted to bring out with translation that isn't immediately apparent to the actual translation?
Well, I mean, that kalos, you know, it isn't agathos, it's kalos for good shepherd.
Yeah.
You know, that's always kind of nice. Agathos is often kind of moral purity or goodness. Mm. Only God is agathos. Kalos can be translated as beautiful or noble or fitting. It's a little more, it's a little richer.
Yeah.
It has to do with competence or can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that he's
hireling is
that he's good for
kind of a harsh word.
That he's good at what he does.
Yeah, that's right. He's good at being a shepherd. Yeah.
Yeah. So he knows how to carry that out. He knows the right things. And he's orderly about it. He's not disordered or being pushed this way or that way. He's in control. He's the regiment. He's ruling.
Yeah, you could translate, he's the right shepherd.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And then you could bring the whole thing in, you know, are you the right man for the job?
Right, yeah.
Okay.
I think the word hireling's kind of harsh as a translation, but.
What do you think it should be?
That's a good question. A worker, I mean, somebody who's paid for working. I mean, that's. Hireling has a very negative nuance, right?
Yeah.
Maybe because of this text, I don't know. But I mean, it does fit here, but I mean, the word itself is not in Greek. It's not a, it's not a negative term.
Yeah.
Hired hand.
Yeah. That's how it's translated.
Hired hand ESV. Would be a little less.
Yeah. Hired hand.
Oh, is it hired hand?
Yeah.
I mean, that hired hand, I think, is a little softer.
Mm-hmm.
Hireling really sounds obnoxious to me.
Yeah.
You would never call someone a hireling in a
positive sense.
It would
sense.
Always be pejorative. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But somebody who's a legit hired hand, I mean, you could be very thankful for. And
yeah. I mean, that's how the guys around here, the farmers around here, talk about the folks that they hire on during planting and harvest. They call them their hired hands.
Yeah, that's not an, it's not pejorative, but I think hireling is pejorative.
Definitely, definitely. So do you think that has colored the way we view the text here? Is the hired hand meant to be pejorative in this text?
I don't think so. I think it's not that he's the problem isn't that he's a hired hand. The problem is that he runs.
Yeah.
Right.
But that's that's the reason, because he doesn't have any skin in the game. They're not his.
Right. Well, that's the problem. I think the problem is he doesn't think they're his, but they are his.
But they are his. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Because we belong to one another. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So here's something I get, right? So I have, don't be a hireling, because we're all called upon to care for Christ's sheep. This isn't just about the ministry, mm-hmm. right? And we're all called upon also to be evangelists, right? That we are to be unifying the flock and not mm-hmm. to be hindering Christ's work by ego or by fear. Mm-hmm. And so to think about what does it mean, this goes along with your regiment idea, but you know, Christ as a shepherd leads us, which mm-hmm. means, of course, we're followers and we're following his commands, but mm-hmm. we're also following his example.
Yeah.
And part of that is to love one another. So, right, the hireling in this account doesn't love the sheep.
Okay.
He doesn't identify with them, doesn't really care what happens to them. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because he doesn't think they're his. But, you know, we do have a... Right. I mean, that's the, am I my brother's keeper? We all know. You are. So that's exactly what this hireling's doing. Hey, the wolf came. I'm not. Am I the sheep's keeper? Yeah, that's what you're hired for.
Right. Yeah. And that is a created duty, right? You're part of that family then. I mean, if you look at the Haustafel, right? They're all the employers and employees. That was meant to be part of the home,
right?
The regimen of the home.
Well, this is all. It's all really kind of stewardship, right?
Yeah,
I mean, the steward wouldn't say, you know, the steward that buries the talents in the sand, right? He can't say, hey, look, it wasn't my money, so. You had a responsibility here that you failed to carry out.
Yeah. So
you don't get out of it by saying it wasn't mine.
So the difference between power and authority, right? You can't share your power, but you can share authority. And your authority can grow by sharing it. Is that what this is about? Like that you're not actually bringing everything under the regiment of God, the rule of God, because you're acting as though he has not shared his authority with you.
Right. Yeah. Well, and of course, you're not only do you not care about the sheep, but you also don't trust the shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not as though these hired hands are all on their own in the wilderness with these sheep,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Jesus is the good shepherd. He does his job. He doesn't fail.
Right.
So why are they running away? I mean, they don't care about the sheep, but they also don't think that Jesus will protect them.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's a total lack of, and then why? I think ego is of course involved, or pride, and then of course also just fear of pain or fear of loss.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're not good hired hands.
Right.
Agathos or Kalos.
So then do you talk about how you are a hired hand of the good shepherd and what that competent shepherd, he's not like the guys who will use and abuse you and then throw you out to get someone younger and more stronger or so he can pay you less. He's not like that.
Right. He's the good employer.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I guess
if
we're talking about it in terms of like, so if there's our duties given to hired hands, then okay, so how does our Lord embody like the perfect employer?
Yeah, I think the part of the problem is that our our concept of employment is so abstract because so much of what we're employed to do is meaningless or close to it. I mean, it doesn't have, right? I mean, if you're stamping out parts, I mean, I get it. It has value in terms of economics and other things, but it's harder to see the value of it or to recognize it in the same way as when you're, you know, growing crops or tending animals that are going to be slaughtered or fleeced or whatever, right? So
you're a little further removed from the benefits, so to speak. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, and I think the benefits to your neighbors directly, right? You don't see them actually, you know, enjoying the fruits of your labor. If you grew grapes and turned it into wine and then shared it with your even sold it to your neighbors and then saw them enjoying it, right? That's a little more direct. And so to not have that, you know, just to be in a factory in the sort of most extreme case and never to see what happens, you know, that affects the way that we treat employees, affects the way that we think of our work, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So I think that's part of what makes it difficult to use the language of employer, but.
Well, I don't know that I'd want to use the word employer. I'm just thinking if we're looking at it in those kind of terms, like.
Yeah, what, it's right though. Yeah.
Yeah. Because you are right. I mean, so my father, before he retired, was a salesman, and he sold steel for U.S. Steel, and then he sold like tanker trailers for spreading and delivering asphalt, right? And I remember growing up, I remember him, if we were on the road, he'd say, hey, that's the steel I sold, right? Nice. So. Or that's really like it. Or when he saw the name brand of the tanker trailer that he was engaged in selling for the company, he's like, yeah, that's the tanker trailer that I sell. So there is something to that, right? Where you're seeing the end result on the road and how it's, you know, to dovetail to your point that sometimes we can be kind of far removed from that.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So it is the right thing. I mean, again, though, like it just is more clean if you have a hired hand who's actually, you know, bunking in the bunkhouse and eating meals with the family and, right? I mean, all of that kind of community sort of thing.
So do you try to describe that? Like in
maybe
give that kind of picture, draw them a mental picture of that with your words and then relate that to the life that you have been drawn into as a hired hand in the church.
Yeah. I think you really need to take it to the church. I mean, you could take it to any of the estates in a way, but here, I mean, he's talking about those who hear his voice will be one flock under one shepherd. Mm-hmm. And this is kingdom of the right, not kingdom of the left.
Okay.
I mean, it could be applied to the kingdom of the left, but right. He's talking about the church. Mm-hmm. And, you know, actually knowing him and being known, that's that intimacy and affection, mm-hmm. right? So yeah, I would say that, you know, this is the part of, again, right? We're all called upon to work in this kingdom and to evangelize.
Yeah. You're
right?
Not
to care
a number,
for the sheep.
You're not a time card. You are known. He knows,
he knows
your name.
Yeah. You're not coming to a restaurant, you know,
right?
When you come to church, you're coming to grandma's house and, you know, you're expected to pitch in.
Oh, right.
Oh, I remember this is a kind of terrible story for my poor wife, but when we were first married, you know, we'd been dating and stuff for a while. And of course, when Jackie came to my mom, when we came to my mom's house, you know, she was a guest. And after we got married, we were over there for something and had dinner. And then Jackie came into the living room or whatever without helping with the dishes. And my mom came and got her. And it was a little awkward. But I'm thankful for it in hindsight. I think Jackie is too. She actually loved it because it actually gave her something to do when she felt part of it, mm-hmm. you know. Boy, I'll tell you what, she was and still is to this day, you know, she's the first one to be doing dishes at my mom's sink to, you know, even quicker than my sisters. but it was painful, you know, in the moment, but it was a good rebuke, I think, and it paid off. And Mm-hmm. But there is that sort of, right, when you're part of the family, you pitch in. Yeah. And
well, if you're anything, if your mom is anything like you, I'm sure she said it in the best possible way.
Yeah. So my mom could be listening to this, but it's unlikely. Everybody loved my dad. My dad was super nice. I'm like my mom. I take after my mom almost completely. I would like to be more like my dad, but I'm not. Yeah.
Well, she was always kind to me when I stayed with her. So that
yeah, you didn't stay long enough. You would have found out. No, she's
so. But
she's pretty direct.
There's something to that, right? Like you, depending on personality, you could bring it out. Like, hey, you're part of the family now. We'd love for you to come and help. Or something to that effect without it being awkward. But I don't know that I would be able to do it. Lauren, maybe. She has a little more tact than I do.
I don't remember. I mean, I remember it, but I mean, I don't remember exactly what she said. It was just sort of clear that it was a rebuke. And I mean, Jackie jumped and did exactly, but you know. But then, I mean, the great part about that was from then on, she knew what the expectation was.
Yep.
And it actually gave her a way to participate and be included, and you know, so
well, that's exactly right, because you're being treated as one of the family now, like you're not on the outside, you're not a guest, and that's a really good thing to do.
It is, but it did hurt in the moment.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, you know, she lived through it.
Okay, so what about the fivefold use here?
Well, I mean, we've certainly got doctrine in that we hear his voice, right? That is his word, and we follow it, we believe in it, and that he is the one then that also makes the Father known. Mm-hmm. So really this idea of all theology is Christology, or that all doctrine ultimately has to be Christological to really be doctrine, that we're not engaged. So you could actually, you could talk about doctrine as the doctrine. What is doctrine?
Okay.
It's not trivia, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not the population of Jerusalem at the time of Jesus. It's the fact that Jerusalem is the city of peace, you know, where mm-hmm. Melchizedek was king and, you know, those sorts of things. So doctrine always has to tie to Christ and who he is. And I think you could also go one step further and say that it always is tied in some sense, because Christ's character is tied to this, to the atonement or to justification. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's he doing here, right? To know Christ is the point of doctrine, not just to know facts. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's sort of obvious, but sometimes I think we do forget it because it can feel like, you know, this is a history lesson or this is a geography lesson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the sheep know him, right? The sheep don't know trivia. They know Jesus.
Yeah. Which means they also know that his word.
Yeah, right. And that's how they know him, right? Is through his word. Mm-hmm. And right, every bit of his word actually reveals him and his character. Mm-hmm. And right. So that's why, you know, the stuff that we're, I mean, the others, the thing we're accused of frequently in Christianity in America is that, you know, we're know-it-alls who are too strict and who are making mountains out of molehills, right? Mm. We're not, because we actually, these things matter, and they matter because they impact the faith in the, you know, most direct way. Mm-hmm. So it's not as though we're saying we shouldn't take communion together because you think Jerusalem had 35,000 people at the time of Jesus, and I think it had 50. I mean, we don't care about that, right? That's what I mean. It's not trivia. When we talk about the 6 days of creation, we're not talking about trivia,
right?
Right. We're talking about actually the goodness of God who doesn't use death and power and violence to evolve human beings. You know, it's not the survival of the fittest,
right?
The survival of the fittest is contrary to the Bible.
Right.
That idea, because it's actually the love of the weakest. So, but people often act as though what we're doing is, you know, making this big stink about something that's not related to the actual matters, and nobody can really know. Mm-hmm. Well, we can know, and we have to know, not that we don't have holes in our knowledge or need rebukes and corrections from the scripture, but look, the sheep know him.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
it's not trivia. It matters.
It matters.
And in fact, I pull this all the time, but whenever anybody tries to pretend like it is, then I always just say, well, then great, let's just do it my way. Then it turns out you find out they care a lot more about it than they pretended.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So they're like, oh, this doesn't matter. You say it's the bodily presence of Jesus, you know, okay. Well, okay. Well, if you say okay, well, then just let me have it my way.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm the weaker brother then.
Yeah. But turns out then when you say it that way, all of a sudden, you know, their opinions become more important.
So. Okay. So doctrine, and then the refutation is that it's just trivia, but these things aren't, that doctrine really isn't life. There isn't a person who's standing behind these words who died and rose again, but they're just words.
Right. That would be and they're not actually significant. And, you know, the more sophisticated people, you know, have this way of looking past them.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a really obnoxious conversation with a bartender, where she tried to, thought she would, finds out, you know, she's known for a long time that I'm a Lutheran minister. And so she thought she would catch me with some of these clever things, you know,
mm-hmm.
And it was so dumb. I couldn't believe it. So she was, the first one was something like, hey, aren't we all the children of God? And if so, then isn't everybody having incest? And I'm just like, look, what am I dealing with here? You know? You got me. You got me. My whole faith is a travesty because you've discovered this loophole problem, you know?
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't even asking about like the children of Adam and Eve. I mean, it was just like a total idiotic, kind of thing. And, that sort of way that we're treated sometimes is just shocking, but that's the view of the world, right? Without ever having studied the Bible, without ever having really given any real effort to actual theological engagement, people just assume it's the whole Kruger-Dunning effect. But they're just they're convinced that they've got this all figured out and they can see right through it.
Yeah, and these are not serious people.
No, right.
Yeah. So, how did you respond? Did you at all?
I did a little bit, but I was in a bar, and and she was being an idiot, and I just said, "Well, the Lord has a special place for blasphemers," and she just laughed and like it was a big joke, and I went on with my darts, but yeah.
That is awesome. I want to get a picture of you with those Thug Life glasses on with that quote on it. Well, the Lord has a special place for blasphemers. And then the Thug Life glasses come. That was a great response.
I learned that. I didn't learn that exact line, but I definitely learned that attitude from Eugene Krieger, a sainted pastor from Michigan. And, He pulled this one time. It was so funny. We were at this restaurant, and this poor girl is trying to wait on us, and she's just jabbering on about her own life and her children and all this different stuff, and it was just obvious she was a mess. And Krieger says, "What does your husband do for a living, dear?" And he was in his 70s at the time. And she's like, "Oh, I don't have a husband," and it was just this perfect, like, you know, Jesus with the woman at the well, and I just couldn't believe it at the time. I was so horrified by it. But then he, you know, he was like, "Oh, well, if you have children, you're supposed to have a husband."
Mm-hmm.
It was great. I thought, why am I pussyfooting around these unbelievers who are being obnoxious with their? I mean, this woman was, she wasn't behaving that badly, but she was kind of throwing this, I don't know, promiscuous lifestyle in our face, you know?
Yeah. And if you take it, they'll keep doing it.
Yeah, it was, I think, you know, right. I think what I was doing, or what I wanted to do at the time, was just nod so that she would go away and we wouldn't have to listen to her anymore. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really want to, you know, rebuke her, but he did.
Yeah.
He totally rebuked her. I was like super embarrassed in the moment, though it was hilarious.
Yeah.
But afterwards, you know, I just thought, hey, that was a good response.
Mm-hmm.
Because he didn't actually ignore the reality the way I was.
Yeah. I mean, she had already put it out there.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
She was wanting, it seems, your approval.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you sort of give your approval by just being silent in the face of some of this stuff. And, I mean, maybe that sometimes and in some places that might be the right way to do it. But shouldn't always be.
Yeah. And it should never be an approval of continuing never, down
right.
the path.
Sometimes of, silence might be.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, when you're at the, you know, I mean, if you go to the wake of your homosexual cousin, you know, I mean, that might not be the time, you know, to rebuke your aunt, you know? So, I mean, sometimes just being quiet about details might be the right thing to do, the compassionate thing to do. But at some point, she needs to be told something, right?
Yeah. I mean, if it's at the wake, it's already too late.
It's already too late. So you don't need to make a scene there is what I'm thinking. Yeah. But, you know, at some point you do. She does, you know, need to hear the gospel and be comforted and find out that even if her son's in hell, she doesn't have to go there.
Mm-hmm.
And her other children don't, right?
Right.
And Jesus loves her anyway, despite the mistakes she made. And right. So at some point you want to preach this gospel to her and the like, but maybe right then's not the time. So I think sometimes being quiet is the right answer,
mm-hmm.
but I think we probably fall back on it more often than we should because we're not being quiet out of compassion. I think we're being quiet out of politeness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This bartender was not being polite.
No. And that's not all. Our duty to be polite in return.
Right. Exactly. You know, she brought it up. She was the one to pretend like she wanted to have a spiritual conversation.
Right.
And then, you know, pulls this great gotcha, you know, idiocy on me. So there you go.
Oh, geez. I wish I could follow you around for a couple of weeks just to see how this all happens. All right. So any other doctrines? I mean, is this the time to go into the I ams, all the statements?
Well, that is a possibility. One other, before we get there, though, I mean, there is something to be said about unity, right? Okay. Because he says there will be one flock and one shepherd. And so, you know, the congregation is to be united in doctrine, in mission, and in affection. So that sort of goes along with the caring for one another. But the whole idea of what is unity, that's related to what we were talking about a minute ago, but a little bit different. And to recognize that it's God's work to unite the church. I mean, we don't want to hinder that work. We want to be part of it. But we can't create it just because we want it.
Mm-hmm.
It's God's work to create peace on earth also. And we can be, blessed are the peacemakers, so we can be part of that work. But, you know, we can't just walk into the Ukraine and say, I declare peace, mm-hmm. right, and make it so, right? We can say it, but it's not real. There's a temptation on the part of the Christian who is desperate, in a sense, for there to be unity in the church, to pretend that there's unity when there isn't.
Mm.
And so, you know, we can't declare unity where there isn't unity. That's what happens all the time with these ecumenical movements mm-hmm. and or ecumenical kinds of things and with open communion.
So and, what's the you know, role I of it. The under-shepherd in this regard in terms of not allowing people to or for the sentimentality of like we'll just go along to get along, at least within the fellowship of the congregation itself? What's that role? Is it to bring these things up, to talk about them, to give them the light of day.
Yeah. Well, we declare unity where there really is unity, right? Mm-hmm. Amongst us, we actually have doctrinal unity based upon the Word of God as expressed in the Book of Concord, right? Mm-hmm. We can say, here's unity, real unity. Mm-hmm. And we rejoice in this and we celebrate it and we seek, you know, others and, you know, for there to be one flock. But we're not going to, I mean, part of the whole fivefold use, right, is that we're going to name errors and divisions and, you know, the like. So I think, yeah, we have to name it. We have to recognize the reality of it. It is not the way it's supposed to be. Well, you know, lots of things are not the way they're supposed to be because of sin. And again, we don't wipe out the lack of what things should be by simply declaring it. We're not God. Mm-hmm. We can't say there's peace in the Ukraine. I mean, we could say it, but we'd just be lying to ourselves and to others. And they might actually get hurt if they believed us.
Yeah.
And so we can't just say there's unity with the Methodists or whatever because we wish there was because my grandma's a Methodist.
Yeah. And I'm not primarily talking about that. I mean, within the congregation itself.
We create unity by doctrine, by teaching.
Okay.
Or we create, I mean, God creates it, but you know what I mean, right? The more doctrine, the better. Because the more we're actually understand who Jesus is, know him, and he knows us, and we're bound together in that reality.
So what are the things present in the average Missouri Synod congregation that are points of division, not unity, that are corrected by doctrine?
Well, I think the doctrine of creation and sexual stuff is huge because of the pressure from the culture that we tolerate false doctrine in regards to those things because it's there's so much pressure to do it. Mm-hmm. Other places would probably be things like open communion. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, the sorts of errors that we're prone to looking past because they're too painful to address. Mm-hmm. Those would be the big ones, I think. I don't think we have a lot of, blatant Christological or Trinitarian heresies. And at least for the most part, our people are going to give lip service to believing in inerrancy and the inspiration of Scripture. So it's sad, but I think it's kind of what we tolerate or what appear on the surface is sort of the more shallow issues, but they're the more perverted issues in a way too. They're the less serious things. It's like, so we don't actually spend time caring enough about the Trinity to actually have division over it.
Hmm. Yeah. So what are the things that the average Missouri Synod congregation permits or allows that in the end it ends up promoting?
I mean, I think weak catechesis, right? Weak, both in formal catechism instruction, you know, we just do things like the kid gets to eighth grade, we're just going to confirm him. We're going to confirm adults without any memory work or not in any kind of rigorous catechesis for adults at all. We pretend like the youth catechesis is rigorous, but, you know, the truth is we're just going to confirm everybody no matter what. So both of those things play into it. And then I think a kind of lack of doctrinal preaching. Yeah, I think both of those things lead to, and I think irreverent or casual leading of the worship service, all that plays into like not taking any of this seriously. This is a social club or, you know, a kind of heritage society that we belong to because of our parents or something. And it's not, this isn't life or death. And this isn't actually the family that I actually love. Do you think, I mean, what would you say to those questions? Did you have something in mind or?
No, I'm just thinking like, you know, we all have the things that, one of my members, you know, lives and works in the business world and they've said often, you know, what you permit, you promote. And, that always kind of sticks in the back of my mind. Like, so are there things that I'm permitting by inaction or by not talking about that in the end is actually promotion of those things? And what would those things be?
Maybe non-church attendance.
That would be part of it, yeah.
I mean, we just, you know, people don't come to church and we pretend that we didn't notice.
Right.
And, you know, just like everything's fine.
Yeah.
And then we end up kind of promoting, like, it's no big deal if you don't come to church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, carrying so-called delinquent members for years at the extreme, but even, you know, just not noticing week to week.
Yeah.
That seems like we maybe are promoting a very lax attitude towards that.
Well, I mean, I
lack
too,
of preparation.
Like, yeah, lack of preparation, all that kind of stuff. What it would be an interesting discussion, I think, to take up the topic of like revamping catechetical work. Like, what does that look like? How do we think that we're being, you know, very strong in catechesis when actually we're not?
Yeah. And the funny thing is, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And does that translate into number of years that you have it? And like all the requirements that are there, because I think, you know, there's some people who have like years and years of catechism classes, and maybe that's really what you're supposed to have, but what does that discussion look like?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because it's such a perennial topic, and I mean, it's gotta be 3/4 of D-min dissertations are written on their catechism program. I mean, it's just everybody's doing this all the time, and everyone thinks he's doing a good job, and no one else is.
Mm.
You know, it really is. We can see it's a problem,
yeah.
And we're trying to fix it ourselves. But no, I don't know what I'm saying, except that it's a huge topic that's easier to recognize than actually address. And I don't know if we have the humility to actually address it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, so if someone asked me, like, if I were king and I could just change it.
Yeah.
You know, what would I do? I think I'd have like a year of, or a time of instruction for First Communion and then like all of high school. So they get First Communion, and then during high school, all 4 years, we're going to go through like Old Testament intensive, New Testament intensive, Catechism intensive, and then like apologetics 4th year.
Yeah.
But that's probably too late.
Yeah, I mean, really, the answer is it's just that catechesis can never, never end.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing, is that we're just constantly engaged in it, that everybody in our parishes should be reciting the catechism itself every day, you know, and everybody should be reading the Bible every day and praying every day and reciting the catechism. And, you know, no one should ever graduate from this, but you know that the sermons ought to be catechetical, and then there ought to be other catechetical events like Bible classes and it just can't end. It just can't end. It doesn't end. Catechism just keeps going.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, that's only going to really, I mean, we're all going to live in the reality that only a percentage of the congregation is going to actually embrace that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. All right. What about training in righteousness and rebuke?
Well, we did a little bit. Don't be a hireling, right? Mm-hmm. Actually care about your brothers and sisters. Let's look at the I ams as a dot. I don't know what this would fall under.
Okay.
But we have an I am in this, right?
Yeah. And two real close. And we had one. I mean, the I am the good shepherd. And just before this, I am the door.
Exactly. Yeah. So you know, you could preach on I am the good shepherd, you know, in a doctrinal way with the whole, you know, Yahweh, the name of the Lord from Exodus. And then, you know, having a predicate is really interesting because I am doesn't have a predicate, right? Mm-hmm. It just is. And now Jesus has these predicates: bread of life, light of the world, door, good shepherd, resurrection, life, way, truth, life, and true vine.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these predicates added to the divine name from Exodus chapter 3.
Mm-hmm.
And here, of course, the good shepherd. So, boy, there's a lot to be said about that. It is, of course, it's not in John, it's in Mark, but That's the answer that's given to Caiaphas in the trial when he says, are you then, I can't remember what he asks him, are you the Messiah, the blessed son or something like that?
The son of the blessed one.
Yeah. Son of the blessed one. And Jesus says, I am. Mm-hmm. And then Caiaphas rends his garments because he's caught him with blasphemy. And then, but in John, you do have that in the Garden of Gethsemane in a similar way. Who are you seeking? They say, Jesus of Nazareth. Right. I am, and they and there's no he in the Greek text, right? And they fall back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to tie that into here, I think, I mean, there's a lot that could be done there. And you don't have all the time in the world in a sermon, but to highlight that could be, you know, that's good catechesis. Probably most of the people have heard that before and are familiar with this. I like to talk, you know, to talk about the fact that in the Old Testament, in our English translations, the convention is to use capital letters for that when the mm-hmm. divine name's behind it, you know. But I just love the idea of there being all of a sudden in Jesus Christ, now become a man, I am has a predicate. And we have a fuller revelation and gift in, I mean, I always have to go to the Trinitarian name from Matthew 28. Mm-hmm. And, you know, John doesn't give that Trinitarian name. He gives these other predicates, but they're the same thing, mm-hmm. right? All of these are intimacy and a gift kind of language, right? Bread of life, light of the world, door, shepherd, resurrection, mm-hmm. way, truth, life, vine. Yeah. None of these are, I am the judge. I mean, that's true, but right there, or I am the power, or I am the almighty, or I am the one, you know, who is, that's the original name. But here you get these beautiful descriptions.
And it's not something we're predicating of him. He's predicating of himself.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not like, you know, you are almighty, or you are the good shepherd. I am. He's giving a fuller revelation of himself by these predicables.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you look at those, you look at the sort of seven of them in a list, I mean, it's good shepherds in the middle. And so if it's, but I mean, it's also just the
so
most.
So this is a chiasm.
I don't think it's really a chiasm, but it is. But I think good shepherd is the most touching of them, the most personable.
Why is that?
Well, it's the only one that's a person.
Gotcha.
I mean, you know, the others are, you know, bread, light, door, you know, so that's probably the reason. But mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to be unmoved by the others, and I'm not, but it seems like I am the good shepherd is really the highlight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what does that reveal about him? If he's predicating this of himself, what is he trying to demonstrate?
He's trying to make himself known, right? I mean, this is exactly, I know my sheep and my sheep know me. Mm-hmm. And he's making himself known. He's opening himself to us.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. I mean, it's quite a surprising. And, you know, again, like if you look at this from the perspective of like Moses, I think Moses would just fall to the ground. I mean, I don't know if they could have foreseen this kind of intimacy from the Holy Trinity to sinful human beings. Yeah, Moses can only see his backside. And here, I mean, what is given to us in holy baptism with the name and what's given to us in the New Testament in general, I mean, it's so beyond and so much greater and gentler and more joyous and, I don't know, familial mm-hmm. than God's goodness in the Old Testament. And that's not to take anything away from that. It's like, I mean, it's the difference between circumcision and baptism, mm-hmm. right? Circumcision's great. I'd much rather be baptized. You know, circumcision is bloody. It's only for boys. You know, it does bring people into the family of God and give them this promise. But what we get in baptism is so much richer and fuller. It's for boys and girls. Mm-hmm. It doesn't hurt. You know, just it gives this name. It washes. I mean, on and on it goes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, I mean, the same kind of thing with the sacrament of the altar compared to the Passover. You know, the Passover is kind of gross. You got to eat the lamb's cooked with the entrails in it. It's kind of sad because you got to raise this lamb and then kill it. And you got to leave your home, right? I mean, you got all that stuff with the Passover. Hey, again, it's beautiful and wonderful and joyous because the angel of death passes over. And even though we're guilty, we're spared. But you know, the sacrament of the altar doesn't have killing any lambs in it or any bloody mess or any, you know, right? And it's not reserved for once a year, and it's not reserved for Jerusalem. I mean, mm-hmm. It's so much greater.
Yeah.
So I'd say I Am the Good Shepherd stands in that a very parallel relationship to, you know, the Exodus 3:14, that this name giving is really a privilege.
Okay. So is this the comfort then, or the consolation?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, this, yeah. I mean, this is a joyous Sunday in which we don't sing any Lutheran hymns. We're reduced to Scottish and English hymns on Good Shepherd Sunday.
Well,
why don't the Lutherans have any hymns on this?
I don't know.
I have to confess, I don't have to, but I will. I do. I love those hymns. They're so fun to sing. Mm-hmm. But you know, we don't have a great doctrinal Lutheran hymn on Psalm 23.
No,
that's interesting. I wonder why.
Yeah, that'd be in all of the Lutheran hymn writers, we have none.
I don't know of any. Maybe they've just been overshadowed because this Anglican stuff is so fun, but I'm not aware of any.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm forgetting something.
Yeah,
I think
I don't know enough about it.
I don't either. Maybe somebody who's listening can fill us in.
Yeah,
because
can teach us. Okay, so what do you think you're gonna focus on?
Well, I liked this kind of threefold thing of redeeming, knowing, and uniting, but I also like this predicate thing. So mm-hmm. I haven't, probably one of those two.
Okay.
What are you thinking?
I don't know yet. I kind of like the unity, so the doctrine unity, but have that play into shepherd versus hired hand.
Yeah.
And that, you know, hired hand isn't necessarily bad, but you can make it bad.
Yeah. It is kind of a hard Sunday to preach.
Yeah.
You know, you're still sort of a little tired maybe from Holy Week. And the Good Shepherd thing seems sort of obvious and almost trite, I think. That's that sort of sentimental side of it.
Yeah.
That I think can be kind of disabling of the preacher in a way.
Have you ever summarized Walther's sermon on how sheep should judge their shepherds for
no.
this? He's got this really, really wonderful sermon on this text, on how sheep should judge their shepherds.
That would be great. I'll have to, where is it? Is it in the new stuff? The new?
I don't know if it's in the new one. I know it's available online, and I can certainly find a copy of it there. I think I have in my files on my computer an electronic copy of it.
Yeah, that sounds very good.
And that would be a great theme too, just how sheep
ought
to judge their shepherds.
Yeah, how do you know if your shepherd's a hired hand?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's, yeah, absolutely. So...
it is a sermon that I typically share with new batches of elders.
Oh, okay.
And just say, hey, this is part of your duty.
Right.
So, I mean, it's really every Christian's duty, but...
I always say, tell the kids at confirmation, this is part of the reason that you're, you know, going through this catechism so that you can judge the pastor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
According to the Bible.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And the catechism.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll
All right.
seek that out and send it your way so you can take a look at it.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we'll pick up with Easter 4 then.
All right. Thanks, Jason.